Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Dorothy Gundy, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Pete Musto.
Liz O'Sullivan says she felt lucky when she started working at the artificial intelligence, or AI, company Clarify in 2017. The New York City-based business develops computer systems that do work that normally requires human intelligence. O'Sullivan's job combined two of her main interests, technology and morality. But she soon found herself in a difficult situation. Clarify was one of several businesses working on a program for the United States military. It is called Project Maven. The companies were asked to develop image capturing and object identification tools for drone aircraft. After talking with friends and coworkers, O'Sullivan recognized that this kind of technology eventually could be used for autonomous weapons, operated without direct human control. In January, after talking with a group of Clarify workers, she wrote to the company's chief executive officer, Matt Zeiler. She wanted him to clarify whether the technology would be used to create weapons. She also asked Zeiler to take action to ensure a series of ethical measures. Zeiler later explained at a meeting that Clarify likely would provide technology for autonomous weapons. O'Sullivan resigned from her job the next day. "I was very surprised and had to follow my conscience," she told the Associated Press, or AP. Zeiler and Clarify did not answer a request for comment from the AP. But he has said that the company's Project Maven involvement is linked to its goal of increasing human progress with continually improving AI.
O'Sullivan considers herself part of a growing movement against unethical technology. Over the past 2 years, U.S. tech employees have tried to remake the industry by pushing for more control over how their work is used. They are also calling for better working conditions, job security, and higher pay for workers in related fields. At U.S.-based Amazon and Microsoft, workers demanded the companies stop providing services to Palantir, which manufactures computer software. Palantir provides technology to federal government agencies, including Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and the U.S. Army. Amazon employees have urged their company to move to renewable energy and clashed with its chief, Jeff Bezos, at a meeting for Amazon shareholders. Last year, many Google employees temporarily stopped working to protest the way their company treats sexual misconduct cases. Google workers also recently signed a letter protesting Project Dragonfly. Dragonfly is a search engine that would follow China's restrictions on the internet. Workers at Salesforce, Microsoft, and Google have protested their company's ties to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, ICE, and the military. Many high-tech workers are paid well and have unlimited vacation time, but they question the effects of their work. Some have joined with unskilled service and contract workers, pressing their employers for better work conditions and pay. Vina Dubal is a professor at the University of California, Hastings College of Law. Dubal has spoken with many tech workers. She says they are feeling sure of themselves because of national and international existential crises. They recognize tech companies have more power than any multinational corporation has had in a long time, she noted.
The movement for change is especially strong in the San Francisco Bay Area, which was once known for activism and progressive culture. But the area has experienced rising housing costs. The growth of the tech industry has fueled the housing crisis. The AP says Facebook and Palantir did not answer requests for comment. An Amazon spokesperson would not comment on employee activism. But the spokesperson noted the Seattle-based company supports renewable energy and provides good pay and humane conditions at areas where its products are stored. A Microsoft spokesperson said the company, also based in the Seattle area, welcomes comments from its employees and respects differing opinions. A Google spokesperson did not comment on individual incidents, but noted that punishing a worker for speaking out is not permitted. There are many things good about giving employees a lot of voice, said Google's chief, Sundar Pichai, at a conference last November. There are decisions we make which they may not agree with. Amr Jaber works as an engineer at Google. He was among several technology workers at a July demonstration in front of Facebook's San Francisco office. The protest was called in support of the company's food service workers. There is evidence companies are listening.
Google and Facebook promised to pay contract workers better. Google also changed its policies governing sexual misconduct cases after its employees walked out. And following employee criticism, Google decided against renewing its contract with the U.S. military for work on Project Maven. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
American police have long used breathalyzer equipment to test the blood alcohol level of drivers. Now, with more states legalizing the use of marijuana, similar devices are being developed to measure other drug levels in a person's system. Unlike alcohol breathalyzers, police have had no devices for measuring marijuana levels during traffic stops. Current methods for identifying drug levels require small amounts of blood, bodily fluids, or hair. Such tests can take a long time and only measure recent drug use, not whether a person is currently under the influence. Two companies recently announced they had created marijuana breathalyzer devices and plan to market them to police agencies. University researchers also released details of a device they developed to provide immediate readings for marijuana levels. The devices are designed to measure levels of THC, the substance that gives marijuana users the mental state called a high. California-based Hound Labs, Inc. has been developing breathalyzer technology for several years. The company says it has created the world's first device to measure both alcohol and marijuana levels in a person's system. In late August, Hound Labs announced it had raised $30 million in new financing to boost manufacturing and marketing efforts. The company says its research is backed by a test study involving its breathalyzer device called the Hound Breathalyzer. The study, led by researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, found the device can measure THC throughout a 3-hour window after a person smokes marijuana. Hound Labs said this finding is important because other major research has shown that people are usually most impaired within 3 hours of smoking marijuana. Mike Lin is the founder and CEO of Hound Labs. He is also a doctor. He told the Digital Trends website the development process for marijuana breathalyzer technology was complex. This is because the amount of THC that exists in breath is about a billion times less than alcohol, Lin said. It's like identifying 25 or 30 specific grains of sand on a beach that's well over a mile long, he told the website. Hound Labs says on its website the device returns THC results within minutes. It can capture two measures, one to find immediate use and one for later. And the company says the device can record recent marijuana use, whether the user smoked or ate the drug. A Canadian-based company called Santec Labs is also developing a breathalyzer device to measure THC levels. Santec has the backing of major Silicon Valley technology investor Y Combinator. The company's website says its breathalyzer can measure both alcohol and THC levels. Santec says the device was designed to assist officers who suspect drivers they stop may be under the influence, but no alcohol is discovered in breathalyzers. Researchers from the University of Pittsburgh recently announced that they too had built a breathalyzer to detect THC levels. The team published its results in the journal ACS Sensors. The researchers say their breathalyzer system uses microscopic tubes of carbon that are about 100,000 times smaller than a human hair. THC molecules attach to the surface of the nanotubes, and this changes their electrical properties. The speed at which the electrical currents recover then signals whether THC is present, a university statement said. Sean Huang is a doctoral student in chemistry at the University of Pittsburgh who helped lead the research. He says the carbon nanotube technology used was not available just a few years ago. Machine learning technology was used to teach the breathalyzer to recognize the presence of THC based on the recovery time of the electrical currents, Huang said. The process works even when other substances, like alcohol, are present in breath, he added. The manufacture and marketing of such devices is likely to grow in the coming years, especially in states with legalized marijuana. However, if law enforcement begins using such devices, rules would need to be created to define lawful and unlawful levels of THC in drivers. I'm Brian Lynn.
Now we bring you our American History Program, The Making of a Nation. Today we look at the start of the American Revolution. Here is Steve Ember.
The road to revolution in the late 1700s took several years. There were protests against the British policy of taxing the colonies without giving them representation in Parliament. To prevent trouble, the British sent thousands of soldiers to Boston, the largest city in Massachusetts. Jane Gordon, the Director of Education and Public Programs at the Massachusetts Historical Society, explains the mood at the time.
We're looking at a time of great tension. We're looking at a time when there's an expectation, I think, on both sides that something will happen, but nobody knows exactly what or when.
On March 5th, 1770, that tension led to violence. It was the end of winter, but the weather was still very cold. A small group of colonists began throwing rocks and pieces of ice at soldiers guarding a public building. They were joined by others, and the soldiers became frightened. They fired their guns. Five colonists were killed. The shooting became known as the Boston Massacre. The people of Massachusetts were extremely angry. The soldiers were tried in court for murder. Most of them were found innocent. The others received minor punishments. Fearing more violence, the British Parliament removed most of the taxes on the colonists. Only the tax on tea remained. The tensions eased for a while. Imports of British goods increased. The colonists seemed satisfied with the situation until a few years later. Then the Massachusetts colony once again became involved in a dispute with Great Britain. The trouble started because the government wanted to help the British East India Company. That company organized all the trade between India and other countries in the British Empire. By 1773, the company had become weak. The British government decided to let the company sell tea directly to the American colonies. The colonies would still have to pay a tea tax. The Americans did not like this new plan. They felt they were being forced to buy their tea from only one company. Officials in the colonies of Pennsylvania and New York sent ships from the East India Company back to Britain. In Massachusetts, the British governor wanted to collect the tea tax and enforce the law. When the ships arrived in Boston, some colonists tried to block their way. The ships remained just outside the harbor without unloading their goods. On the night of December 16, 1773, a group of colonists went out in a small boat. They got on a British ship and threw all the tea into the water. Destroying the tea was a serious crime. The colonists were dressed as American Indians, so the British would not recognize them. But the people of Boston knew who they were. A crowd gathered to cheer them. That incident, the night when British tea was thrown into Boston Harbor, became known as the Boston Tea Party.
And all of a sudden, with the Tea Party, they say, enough is enough.
Gordon Wood, a history professor at Brown University in Rhode Island, says the Tea Party made Britain furious with the colonies. Parliament reacted by passing a series of laws that punished the whole Massachusetts colony for the actions of a few men. One of these laws closed the port of Boston until the tea was paid for. Other laws strengthened the power of the British governor and weakened the power of local officials throughout the colonies. The laws were called the Coercive Acts. Historian Gordon Wood says they helped unite all the colonies against Britain, even though not everybody approved of the Boston Tea Party.
The Virginians are appalled at the Tea Party. They just think that's just terrible, destruction of all that property. But when they see what the British do, the Coercive Acts, they say to themselves, if they can do that to Massachusetts, the British can do that to us. And they're on board. And that really is the turning point.
In June of 1774, Massachusetts called for a meeting of delegates from all the other colonies to consider joint action against Britain. This meeting was called the First Continental Congress. It was held in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in September of 1774. All the colonies except one were represented. The southern colony of Georgia did not send a delegate. The delegates agreed that the British Parliament had no right to control trade with the American colonies or to make any laws that affected them. They said the people of the colonies must have the right to take part in any legislative group that made laws for them. The First Continental Congress approved a series of documents that condemned all British actions in the colonies after 1763. The delegates approved a proposal by Massachusetts saying that the people could use weapons to defend their rights. They also organized a Continental Association to boycott British goods and to stop all exports to any British colony or to Britain itself. Local committees were created to enforce the boycott. One of the delegates to the First Continental Congress was John Adams of Massachusetts. Years later, he would say that by the time the meeting took place, the American Revolution had already begun. King George II announced that the New England colonies were in rebellion. Parliament made the decision to use troops against the colonists in Massachusetts in January of 1775. The people of Massachusetts formed a provincial assembly and began training men to fight. Soon, armed groups were doing military exercises in towns all around Massachusetts and in other colonies. British officers received their orders in April 1775. By that time, the colonists had been gathering weapons in the town of Concord, about 30 kilometers west of Boston.
It's a gentle landscape. There are no great mountains. There are no great valleys or waterfalls. It's a gently rolling hillside farm landscape. There are two rivers that come together to form another river.
Jane Gordon from the Massachusetts Historical Society lives in the area. She describes what the scene must have been like.
The houses are mostly made of wood. Many of them are not painted. In April, the leaves would just be budding out. Things would be greening up. And actually, the first day of the Revolution was a very warm spring day.
The British forces were ordered to seize the colonists' weapons. But the colonists were prepared. They knew that the British were coming. Years later, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote a poem about what happened. The poem is about Paul Revere, one of three men who helped warn the colonial troops that the British were coming.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere on the 18th of April in 75. Hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. He said to his friend, "If the British march by land or sea from the town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry arch of the North Church Tower as a signal light. One, if by land, and two, if by sea. And I on the opposite shore will be, ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm for the country folk to be up and to arm."
When the British reached the town of Lexington, they found it protected by about 70 colonial troops. These citizen soldiers were called Minutemen. They had been trained to fight with only a minute's warning. Eight colonists were killed. Each side accused the other of firing the first shot in that first battle of the American Revolution. It became known as the shot heard round the world. From Lexington, the British marched to Concord, where they destroyed whatever supplies the colonists had not been able to save. Other colonial troops rushed to the area. A battle at Concord's North Bridge forced the British to march back to Boston. It was the first day of America's War for Independence. When it was over, almost 300 British troops had been killed. Fewer than 100 Americans had died. The British troops had marched in time with their drummers and pipers playing Yankee Doodle. A Yankee Doodle was a man who did not know how to fight. The song was meant to insult the Americans, but in the end, they were very proud of it.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.